just let them arrive a little bit late, because we don't know for sure they're going to be here, and I don't want to wait indefinitely. So with that, I call the meeting to order. Can we have a roll call, please?
Kathleen McMonagle. Elsie Weber.
Here.
Hugh Gibbons. Rick Whitney.
Here.
Missy Pringle.
Here.
Bill Goggins. Ron Kaplan.
Here. Chair would entertain a motion to dispense with the reading of the minutes.
I move we dispense with the reading of the minutes of July 24th, July 31st, and October 23rd.
Is there a second?
I'll second.
Moved and seconded. All in favor of dispensing with the reading of the movements of the minutes, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Okay. So do we have any, let's take them one at a time. July 24th. Meeting minutes. Anybody have any additions, corrections to that?
I have a typo and that's it.
Okay.
Up at the top where they have my name, there's only one B in Weber.
Okay. Anything else on the July 24th minutes? I would add one other typo, and that's on the 2A. And when it says correct the roll call, roll should be R-O-L-L rather than R-O-L-E. And that's all I know. So, someone want to move to approve these minutes with those corrections?
Okay. Just the July 24th?
Let's take them one at a time, yeah.
Okay. I move that we approve the July 24th minutes as corrected. As amended.
Seconded.
Moved and seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Okay. Motion carries unanimously. How about the July 31st meeting minutes? Anybody else have any? I question on these minutes whether the SEPA appeal portion is something that should be included in our minutes. We weren't even present for that, and we're told not to be present for it. Certainly that would be appropriate for the hearing examiner's records, but I don't think that should be part of our record, should it?
Probably not.
Yeah, so I would strike everything related to the SEPA appeal. Any other suggestions? Okay.
I move that we approve the minutes of July 31 as amended.
Okay, so moved and seconded. All in favor? Aye. Motion carries unanimously. October 23rd minutes. They double spelled your name wrong that time, Elsie.
We had a couple of little typos, and I told the girls are doing. But go down to under 2A, where you have Kathleen, and then go over to my name. And
Elise.
It should be E-L-S-I-E, and just one B in Weber. Okay, thank you.
Elise is a pretty name, isn't it?
That's better than mine. I was given
the Okay. Any other corrections? A couple little typos that I noticed were on the second page under 7A. Let's see, the middle part where it says this year the city. And it spells, on the third sentence, it says pedestrian and bicycle traffic, and that bicycle, I think, has got an extra L in there. Just, we like to have our minutes spelled correctly. And then, likewise, 9A, at the bottom, see in the middle there, it says City Council received a challenge of the hearing examiner's recommendation. I think that should be an L-L-E-N-G-E instead of A-N-G-E for challenge.
It's French, it's challenge.
Challenge. Just challenge with an E instead of A. It's So we actually are reading these things. Any other notes? Okay.
I move we approve in October 23rd minutes.
Moved and seconded. Subject to our
corrections.
Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. John, you okay with it?
Aye.
Okay. Motion carries unanimously. And now announce the agenda. We got council member reports and comments. Maybe with the work program. Doesn't look like we're going to have much audience requests. And then we have approval of the 2006 comp plan amendments and zoning map amendments. Study session on the innovative housing program, and then take action on ordinance 4065 floor area ratios. And I'm not aware of any new business after that, so that's the agenda. Anybody have any council member reports and comments?
I have a comment.
Okay.
And it's not meant as a criticism. However, I'm just wondering when on 108th Street the Meriwether sign is ever going to be taken down.
I'll pass that on.
People still ask me, what's going on there?
It's still on 106, too.
Yeah.
Also, they did something major there just before all the power went out. They were putting new boxes, electrical boxes or something, in the ground there. And it didn't say City of Kirkland Utilities on it. They were just plain white trucks.
Secret mission, we can't tell you about.
So I don't know what they were doing, you know.
It was one of the United Nations black helicopters.
Did they have one?
Yeah.
Anybody else have any comments or reports for the good of the order? I want to mention one thing, and you might find this of interest, Paul. Were you here? We had a fellow come in a few months ago who talked about. He has an apartment complex that's right across the street from the Meriwether project, and I'm drawing a blank on his name right now, but
yeah,
he came in and he talked to us about it, and it was like, as I recall, he had like 9 units or 12 units or something in there, and he apparently got caught up in some zoning reductions that were done years, long time ago. Mm-hmm. And all he wanted to do was add a few units that got him back to where the zoning was, as I recall. How was it?
I think he just wanted to improve the 12 units that he had, but in order to do anything, he had to go
that was it. Yeah.
So he just wanted to maintain the density.
That's it. He wasn't going to add density. He just wanted to, and by doing that improvement, he was caught up in the change in the zoning.
And
he said, you know, I'd rather retain the number of units we have, but if I can't at least, you know, improve them without this happening, well, then I'm going to, you know, I've got to consider other alternatives. And apparently, it went nowhere, and so he is now in contract apparently to go forward with demolition of that and replacing it with like 4 high-end, you know, units.
Oh, that's a shame.
Yeah.
Yeah, because that was reasonable housing.
And he, you know, he really did reach out to us and tried to get some support for this, and, you know, we just...
I think we discussed it and said that we wanted to look at whether there could be unforeseen repercussions of what that would mean by going back on, because an ordinance had been passed that had downzoned that thing, and what does that mean if you just disregard that? I mean, and so I think that we wanted to look into it, and just, nothing ever happened.
Yeah.
You want me to check further on that? Do you remember which meeting it was, or his name, or?
I'll be able to. His name will pop up in the back.
You would know him.
Maybe in the minutes, right?
You'd know him for sure. He's developed.
Anthony Sabe.
No, he used to live down at the end of 60th Street, right at the top of the railroad tracks, in a beautiful house there, and he comes to the Hope Down every year, and I will eventually wind around to
his one of us will probably think of the name before the meeting's over. Yeah. I know, I'm drawing a blank right now. I should have made a note of it, but I ran into him at Houghton Market yesterday, and he mentioned it to me, and it just saddened me.
Yeah.
So.
Me too.
So, that's I guess all for council member reports and comments. We have no audience. Work program review, I guess, is pretty well covered by this calendar you've given us. Or, oh, no, you have something to add there, Paul?
Actually, I have a couple things to add.
Oh, that's okay.
Yeah. One, you will notice that the city council is still discussing the miscellaneous zoning code amendments, and they have scheduled that for their January 3rd meeting. And after they complete it at that point, we'll come back to you in January, at your January meeting.
Okay.
They're working through several issues regarding home occupations and reasonable use provisions and a number of things you'd looked at before, but they're just kind of getting into this right now, and they'll probably be, we think, adopting it in early January. If not, it'll come to you in February. So,
okay.
The second thing to mention is that we are, as you noted earlier, the Planning Commission met at a retreat to talk about the work program, and it was that dark and stormy night when we met up in McCullough Park, and lights were flickering and trees were crashing, but we kept on meeting. So.
We could have lost the whole Planning Commission.
So probably at your January meeting, I'll bring back the revised draft based on their discussion and present that to you. It's going to the City Council at a joint meeting between the Planning Commission and City Council in February. One of the things obviously on that work program are the next neighborhood plans, the Lakeview and Houghton neighborhood plans. And we originally proposed that we do one at a time because of the staff resources and so forth. They're interested in trying to do them both together, but we'd have to look at that, see how that might work, and see if we can make it happen that way. We did three neighborhood plans recently. It took 3 years to do that, so we're trying to find ways to speed those up, but there may be other ways to approach it that we may want to talk about. So that's coming forward of interest to you all. So.
Okay. But we're still on schedule for doing it this coming year, right?
Yes, we're probably looking at the middle of the year to start that process, because we have a number of things we want to complete in the first 3 or 4 months of 2007, but sometime probably in, say, June, July, we'll come back to you. And really, we need to talk to you about what your role is in that neighborhood plan, too, how you want to participate, how we want to make this work between you and the Planning Commission and so forth. Is there some sort of citizen advisory group we want to form, or do you want to use you as the sounding board? There's a lot of different ways to look at this approach, so we'll be talking to you more about that down the road.
Okay, great. I guess we have no audience to be requesting anything from, so with that we should move into the 2006 comp plan amendments and zoning map amendments.
Well, this should be pretty straightforward. You've seen this before. There isn't a lot of substantive change from the last time, and there's not a lot of substantive change to the actual comp plan and zoning unit of itself, and in fact, very little that affects Houghton in terms of any major policy shifts. We have a new capital improvement program. We have some new policies dealing with physical activity and healthy lifestyles, and we have several just editorial and grammar corrections. So unless you have any questions, we recommend you adopt the resolution to amend the comprehensive plan and go from there.
Does anybody have any questions? I think we fully reviewed this once before and pretty much had come to a conclusion that we were in agreement with the changes that we were proposing.
Right.
So does anybody want to make a motion to approve?
I move with...
You need to speak into the mic so we record you. Remember that?
No.
Here's your little sign out there.
Oh. I move we approve resolution number 2006-7. With the comprehensive plan amendments and related zoning map changes.
Okay, is there a second?
I would second that.
All right. Any discussion? All in favor of this motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Well, motion carries unanimously. Which is fortunate, because I think that's about the way all the motions need to carry today. They don't count.
They're not
going to
count.
So, all right. So that is taken care of. Now, innovating housing program.
I'd like to introduce Dorian Collins, who has taken over this project from Don Nelson. Don is expecting a baby any minute, any second now. She has passed her due date.
Good for her.
Ooh.
Second.
Wow.
Any time, exactly. And as you know, we completed our evaluation of our innovative housing demonstration projects and that were in North Rose Hill. Joanne's going to give a brief presentation and then turn it over to our consultant, Mike Lewis.
Okay. I just thought I'd come remind you about what this project is. The city approved Ordinance 3856 back in 2002, which was to enable this interim innovative housing program. The goals that are set forth in the ordinance are for the projects to increase the housing supply and choice of housing styles in projects compatible with existing single family, and to promote housing affordability by encouraging smaller homes. So absolute affordability was not among the specified goals. The ordinance also established the process and the interim zoning regulations for these projects. And there were two demonstration projects selected through that that are both in North Rose Hill, Danielson Grove and the Kirkland Bungalows. The city also determined that there should be an evaluation of these demonstration projects prior to moving forward with establishing permanent zoning regulations. So that's where we are now. And we hired a consultant, Mike Lewis, with Michael Lewis and Associates, who's here tonight to give you a presentation on how the evaluation process has gone and what was involved in that. He was responsible for two pieces, really, the community education and public education, and the staff did a technical and code evaluation on some of the different aspects, how they compared to typical housing development. And I'll go over those in just a minute. At this point, the Planning Commission met in November and at that point made a recommendation to the City Council that the Council move forward with developing permanent regulations. And the Council is going to be having a study session on that on January 2nd. So they'll be getting the same presentation that you're hearing tonight and then discussing what they might want to have included in those permanent regulations and if indeed we are to move forward with those. So from the Houghton Community Council, I think we'd like to hear your comments on this after we've heard from everyone tonight, and if there are other incentives that you think are important or if you think that there's something different that should be done, that would be good to hear. And we also noted here this issue of relative affordability versus affordable housing in innovative housing, just to, if you have any strong feelings about that. And that's something that the Planning Commission talked about at length, was that these units really are not affordable to low or moderate income, but by making them smaller and more of them and different kind of housing, you do end up with some relative affordability, but they're also really targeted at housing choice, so that there's a different type of housing. And we do expect that the council will direct staff to proceed with some kind of permanent regulations. So I just wanted to mention quickly that there's a matrix in your packet. It's attachment 3. And if you can't find it easily, I have some extra copies of that. So let me know if you can't find it. It's just a little one page.
It was attachment what?
Attachment 3. It's behind the report. If you want, I could just give you each
an A, B, C, D, E. Is there something behind it?
This is this one.
The development, but it says Danielson Grove. Is that what you mean? Oh,
I know it was hard for the planning commission to find in their packet.
Oh, yeah, I saw this one.
Oh. So right behind attachment G.
Oh,
or H, right behind H, yeah.
Yeah, I'm not sure what that was, attachment H to attachment 2 or something. So this shows you a comparison of these two projects, the demonstration projects, to a typical development, and shows kind of how the density is different, where you would typically have 10 single-family in these two compact single-family projects. There were about 50% more units, and all of these are consistent with the parameters in the ordinance. The lot sizes are smaller, which is part of that. Unit sizes, there's a maximum unit size of 1,500 square feet, and in a typical development, we're seeing closer up to 3,600 square feet. Floor area ratio ended up being smaller, less than what we would normally see. Impervious coverage was also quite a bit lower, rather than up to 50% of the individual lot size. These came out at about at 38% for Daniels and Grove and 30% for the Kirkland Bungalows. There are, I don't know if you've all been out to visit these projects, but there's quite a bit of open space in them. And that accounts for that. Setbacks are somewhat similar, but can be a little less. Parking, they... this will be an issue that the consultant will talk about. They do have two stalls per unit, but the parking is something that some of the neighbors did comment on being an issue. But and traffic is something that you really wouldn't expect more trips to be generated from these necessarily, but we did. That is one thing that we did note, was that there were more trips generated from these projects than from a typical development. And there are more units, but there are also smaller household sizes. So that's something that we're thinking we might want to come back and do another count in a year or so and see if some of that was maybe attributed to the high level of interest in these projects and people driving by, that kind of thing. And then the last row in the matrix shows the sales prices and how they compared to typical sales prices during the same period in North Rose Hill. And they are lower here. But we have noticed through recent flyers that we've seen that the prices are going up, too. So they seem to be popular. So now I'll have Mike Lewis come up and tell you what he found.
Thanks a lot. My name is Mike Lewis. I was retained by the City of Kirkland to do this evaluation of the program. And as you saw on the slide, my job was really to evaluate the reaction of the community to these projects and the reaction of the citizens. But in doing so, also I actually learned quite a bit about the reaction of the marketplace and the economics, so I'll talk a little bit about that as well. I think you have the report in your packet, and I want to make one note about the report, because I think the version you have is not the one that was corrected. If you go back, if you look at the attachments, under attachment D, there's a whole list of things that people talked about when during focus groups, when asked the question, what are the biggest issues facing Kirkland? You'll notice in there that nobody says anything about transportation, which would be kind of an odd thing to ask that question and not have people say anything about transportation. Well, that's because I told at the beginning, don't write anything about transportation, because I know that's going to be the number one one for every one of you, and so let's just not bother with that. That note should have been made on the forum, and it isn't. So if you're reading through it, and it's interesting stuff to look through. It's always useful when you know, you go to all the trouble to recruit focus group participants, and you get them there, and you tell them, you know, you don't tell them anything. You don't tell them why they're there. It's always useful then to ask that question, what are the biggest things on your mind? You always find, and that's really where some of the real springboard for the evaluation or parts of it came from, because a lot of the discussion had to do with development in their neighborhood. Really, they didn't know they were there to talk about housing or anything else, so that kind of came out of nowhere. I'm also a little hesitant to have you read the thing, because you're really into typos, and I was just rereading it before coming here, and I found about three or four, so maybe you'll find them too. When I undertook the evaluation, it was sort of clear to me early on that really the best way to do this was a qualitative approach. Any sort of survey would be really tough, because the level of knowledge of the projects and the whole process was really uneven. A small number of people know a lot about it. Most people know almost nothing. So we opted to do a qualitative approach, which involved a series of meetings. The first one was with people who lived, you know, 1,000-foot radius around each of the projects. 600-odd flyers were sent out for this radius around each of the projects, and we had about a dozen or 15 people at each of the meetings, just open, come one, come all, and talk about the projects. The second set of meetings were formal focus groups, where participants were recruited from outside of the area of the projects. We didn't want people who lived right near them. They had to be homeowners and voters in Kirkland, and from outside there, and then we screened out anybody who belonged to, for instance, a community council or anything like that. We wanted people who, you know, are voters and homeowners, but not necessarily active on these issues. Those were longer groups that were done on Saturday mornings. We met first, toured the, both of the projects and then met afterwards to get people's reactions to them. Third set of meetings were with residents of the projects themselves, people who lived in the, in those two. Fourth meeting with industry representatives, people from the housing industry and real estate and home building. And the final, I met with the project builders themselves, Jim Sewells from the Cottage Company, Eric Campbell, and John Harkness from Cam West. So there was the report is really, you know, smushes together findings from all of those meetings. What I want to run through right now, briefly, what I sort of pulled out is the four big conclusions out of this. There's a whole bunch of other detail you can walk through in there. But sort of four big conclusions that, that came out really throughout the meetings, although obviously with some variation among the different groups. The first one, I think, the projects themselves viewed, you know, to some extent in isolation from what's around them, just looking at the projects, were very well received. I think that just about everybody, even though people who had some reservations about the whole idea, pretty much had to admit that the projects themselves were very well done, very high quality, and, you know, they really couldn't argue with the quality of what was built there. And secondly, the projects were seen pretty universally as offering a choice that's largely unavailable in most of Kirkland. That is, smaller units on less land, in new construction, that is. You can find some smaller units there, but a choice that really isn't available in Kirkland. That choice has been, if you look at the buyer profiles, largely people who had, a lot of them had given up larger houses, downsizing, or some people who had opted for condominiums and then decided they didn't really like being in an attached. They want something smaller but not attached. So the idea is you have this choice of something that is detached but also smaller. And so that was generally viewed as something that was a positive option. The third thing that really came out that wasn't what I was looking for in the first place but kept coming up, again, as a result of this open-ended question at the beginning of meetings, that these are an alternative to what would otherwise happen on the property that people appreciated. Yeah, a big concern is that neighborhoods, a lot of infill development are much really large houses, either through teardowns or on vacant property, and that those larger houses are sort of out of scale with the existing neighborhood. These projects brought back the smaller scale of homes that were kind of in those neighborhoods, now at a higher density, but nonetheless, a lot of people appreciate, they were willing to accept the higher density because the homes themselves are more in scale with what's in the surrounding area. The one issue that came up, as was mentioned, that really in a number of areas had to do with parking. That it was interesting that the city's traffic counters counted more cars. Nobody claimed that they ever noticed more cars as a result of these projects, but they did notice parking. And not that anybody could point to parking as really affecting the neighborhood. It wasn't spilling out around the edge of the property. They didn't notice a lot of parking on the streets in front of the projects, a lot of on-street parking. And that, I think, was sort of interesting. Again, not that it really negatively affected the neighborhood. People just sort of see this visual thing of a lot of cars parked along the streets, which I guess is a little unusual in those neighborhoods. Most people have enough parking on site that you don't see a lot of cars around. So it's sort of a visual thing, but again, not really a functional negative. So again, you know, point number one, I think the projects overall are quite well received within the neighborhoods. Second point, similar projects would likely work pretty well elsewhere in Kirkland, and for looking at it from two ways. The market is clearly there. These projects sold very well. The Kirkland Bungalow sold very quickly. The Danielson Grove sold a little more slowly, but that's a fairly specialized product. That cottage community kind of thing is more of a little more of a niche market, and they were a bit higher priced. But I think the builders themselves, as well as other members of the real estate industry, felt that similar kinds of projects would sell very well in Kirkland. There's a real market for that kind of thing, smaller detached homes in that kind of a price point that's, you know, less than the $800,000 or $900,000 for the full size house. Secondly, I think, again, given the reaction, particularly among the focus group participants, again, who were randomly selected, didn't know why they were there, didn't have a stake, didn't have a dog in this fight at all, very high level of acceptance of these kinds of projects in neighborhoods. At the end of each focus group, after they toured the projects and learned all about them, I just went around the room saying, okay, everybody, one, two, three, how many of you, or would you accept a project like this in your neighborhood? Out of the, I guess we had 27 participants in the focus group, I think only one person said absolutely neither of those projects in my neighborhood. There were a couple of them who said, yeah, I'd take that one, but not that one, or vice versa, but pretty close to unanimity that they would accept a project like this in their neighborhood. Now, having said that, those are very high-quality projects, and you can't always guarantee quality. But, again, I think that a pretty high level of acceptance. So if you say the builders would want to build such things, and neighborhoods would probably be okay with them, at least neighbors who were interviewed, I think there's a pretty good, pretty high likelihood that similar projects would work. Point three, and this is really a little outside the original scope, but I think a little more work is needed on the development standards and the incentive system that the 50% bonus, again, for these, or the 100% bonus for cottage. These two projects made money for their builders, so they didn't, you know, they weren't off the chart there. But other builders who've looked at the same kind of bonus said, pretty tough to make that work. And the reason is fairly simple. If you can build 3,200 or 3,500 square feet of house under the regular zoning, or you do the alternative of 1,500 square feet and you get a 50% density bonus, you're building less square footage. And, you know, square footage is what sells. You can get a bit of a premium because these are a little bit different, so you're not quite, square footage isn't quite translatable, but these guys said, yeah, they could probably still make more money doing the conventional stuff, the big 3,500 square foot houses. Eric Campbell was...
Pardon me, just should we withhold... one question I have on that is it due to... aren't they getting enough extra lots and with such a high premium on the lots that doesn't balance it?
Not quite. What goes the other way is that in these kinds of homes, you're building the most expensive parts of the house,
right.
Kitchens and bathrooms. Mm-hmm. So your per square foot cost is quite a bit higher. Mm-hmm. You don't get the bonus rooms and bedrooms and the cheap space that's pretty profitable. Mm-hmm. You're not getting that. So that kind of offsets. Eric Campbell's thought on that was to fix it. He suggested going higher on the unit size rather than higher on the density. He said if you go much higher on the density, you start to get into a little bit different product category, and then you're dropping, it's a little less desirable, much more dense than that. But another couple of hundred square feet of bedroom or something, he thought, might tip the balance back to where, you know, these would be about as. But again, that's something that needs a bit more work to look at. I just kind of got off the cuff from these people. One guy actually had tried to pencil one of these things out, and he said he couldn't make it work. But again, just something that needs some more work to try to figure out. And then it's really sort of a policy question. Where do you want that balance point to be? Do you want it to be sort of equal, one or the other? So the builders kind of, I can do this or this, or make it more advantageous to do the innovative one. I mean, that's just a policy choice as to where you want to see that point. But I think right now it's tips a little bit away from doing the innovative version. And the builders did know that there are other kinds of things that they could see working, ones that were part of this program or other kinds of housing, and they're listed in the report there that they thought could work within the markets here. The fourth point has to do with affordability, and it was mentioned on the slide there. And this was a very interesting thing because the Innovative Housing Program was very clear about how it was addressing affordability. It was meant to be sort of attack it from the point of view of relative affordability. These homes would sell for less than the homes that would be built on the site otherwise, and that certainly happened. The kinds of houses that would be built there would have been in the maybe $800,000 range, and these were in the under $500,000 to $600,000. So it achieved the policy goal set out by the city. But in group after group, whether it was the neighbors or the focus groups or the others, there seemed to be an expectation that the goal was absolute affordability. People say, well, these aren't affordable. Well, to some level, particular level of income. So even though that wasn't a goal of the city, there was an expectation among a lot of people that it somehow was and that was an appropriate thing to do. So whether that's a you know, a communication problem or a policy problem, I'm not sure. But it was clearly something that was out there, that people were really sort of questioning this. Hey, you know, assumption seems to be if you're going to do something different and you introduce the word affordability somewhere in there, that means that it is affordable at, you know, 80% of median income or 100% or something like that. And so I think there's a little challenge there. Having said that, introducing an affordability component into these kinds of projects would be really pretty tough, mostly because they're not very big. And if you, there's sort of two ways to do an inclusion, some kind of inclusionary thing. One is all units subsidize the affordable one, or the affordable units are sort of scaled back so far that they're naturally affordable. They're not requiring a subsidy. They're just so small and so spec'd down that they are inherently affordable. In either case, that's going to be a little bit tough to do, but I think it's something, I know there's an interest in pursuing that. But it would, again, projects of this scale, it's pretty hard to do that and have those things really fit in. You know, you can try doing a carriage unit over a garage or something like that that might achieve that. So. Those are really the four points, and I, you know, there's a whole bunch of other stuff there, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have about this or any of the other pieces there.
Yeah. I don't think this was your part, never mind.
Sure, else it?
Yeah, I was going to ask him about shoreline, but that's your part.
You made a statement that I'd like to question. You said we can't guarantee quality. Why not?
Well, in terms of, I mean, you mentioned shoreline, and that's an interesting case because that's sort of where this came up.
Yeah.
It's just hard to write enough regulations to get the exact result you want. You know, design. You can do design review and things like that, but it's really hard to get every single detail. Is what I'm saying. So, and again, it's kind of what happened in Shoreline. You know, they saw some projects they liked. The first, you know, outside, the first couple of projects they got were really nice, and then they got one or two that were just not as nice, and things kind of got difficult after that. And that was really my point. Is that, you know, the you just have to remember that the evaluation done here was an evaluation of two really nice projects.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, if people are going to have an expectation that every project done under an innovative program is going to be as nice as those, then you got to figure out how to do that. Because if you just sort of put some standard zoning and development parameters around it, you might get something that's not as nice. Harder to do in Kirkland. I mean, these guys are selling stuff for such high prices that they're not going to build junk. But still, sometimes it doesn't quite come out.
Oh, I think we've seen some junk.
Yeah.
Well, and also the Shoreline project, didn't they? Like, they started out with two, and then they went to eight, and they had, it just went downhill. So then they put a moratorium on the whole thing and said, stop, we're not going to do anything else till we figure out how we can do this right. That's the way I read it in here, anyway.
Well, they had, yeah, what happened was they had about three of them that were pretty nice. Then they had one where, you know, they had the two for one deal there. So if you, it's the same as the one here, you know, you could do two cottages where one single family would fit, or one unit would fit into the existing zoning. And a guy went in and found some property that was already zoned 8 units to the acre, so he went to 16, which was pretty dense for detached housing. And then he went and did a tour of Paulsville Place over in Paulsville and saw the lovely colors they have over there, and he went and tried to do the same with his vinyl siding supplier, and the selection of colors was
hideous.
Yeah. So, you know, those things were kind of, I happen to think that project isn't that bad. It was very affordable, and, you know, it's not as horrible. But, and then apparently there's another one which I haven't seen, which is really pretty ghastly. So, yeah, that's what happened. And they just had they prided themselves on having a conditional use permit where all the conditions could fit on one sheet of paper, which is a nice idea for developers. They like that. But, you know, they didn't quite draw quite as many boxes around it. Then I was later working with the city of Redmond on theirs, and they came out with a cottage ordinance that's, what, about 15 pages, I think, or something like that, because they tried to cover every eventuality, which, again, is a good way to discourage those things from happening, because builders look at that and they say, I'd rather do the easy, rather do the conventional thing because that won't get me in any trouble. So there's a fine line in there where you try to cover the possibilities of things going wrong without causing the builders to say, I can't do that. I'm just not going to subject myself to that. So,
During the discussions, when you talked about affordability, you had mentioned a percentage of the mean income, that sort of thing. What were some of the comments from the focus groups about affordability? Was it anything specific tied to a median income, or was it really the term affordability?
Well, it kind of went all over the place. I think most people in those groups are not familiar with all the terminology of percent of median income and all that sort of thing. They look at it from the point of view of sort of, occupations. Can somebody, and it's all the school teachers and firefighters, they all seem to be the ones who come up here. Can a school teacher afford to live there, or, a store clerk or someone like that? So they kind of look at it that way, and they say, pretty obviously something that's selling for $475,000 to $600,000 is not affordable to a school teacher, at least not a school teacher salary. So they kind of look at it that way, and that would always come up. And I'd say, okay, wait a minute. After we discussed that for a while, I'd say, okay, here was the objective of the city, was this idea of relative affordability. I would say maybe half the people roughly thought that was an acceptable policy objective. Okay, I can understand that. That's a good idea.
Simply the term relative.
Yeah, or just the concept of relative affordability was something, okay, they'd say, I could deal with that. Others are saying, no, affordability is something that the city really needs to work more on in terms of things that really are, genuinely affordable to people with moderate incomes. So it was really kind of a split there, and I was a little surprised by that. I thought people would say, okay, yeah, the idea of absolute affordability at some level of income, that's one kind of thing you try to do. Relative affordability by looking at the unit size and the land cost is kind of another thing you try to do. Those are two different programs. But
I think that people here in Kirkland value, the older people who, we value the lot sizes, we value the open space, we value being able to look through the houses and see the lake or see the mountains or see something. And so if we're going to give that up, if we're going to cram houses closer together, give up some of that and increase our density, I think we feel like we need to be doing that for a reason, not just so that more rich people can move in. Okay, maybe it's only a single rich person and his wife or something, but I mean, it's just sort of okay, so we're just creating more houses for rich people, and what did we get out of that? Now, unfortunately, the flip side is otherwise we'd have a big mega mansion there, right? So we're getting
there. Well, also, I think there's some other benefits from the standpoint that if you cluster units, you can actually preserve view corridors, you get better open space, you can do more low-impact development type things with rain gardens and bioswales and infiltration that might reduce some of the load on the stormwater system. So it's not just densely compacting them to take away the views. Actually, there's a better way to arrange sometimes the units or the lots, or to take advantage of the natural forms of the property itself. So there's some other things that might come into play.
Well, and I did notice that, and I appreciated that it did have less impervious surface,
mm-hmm.
and it was less lot coverage, and that's, I'm all for that. So that's one reason why I would say, okay, there is a little bit of a trade-off here, then I would definitely go for this option. But I think that a lot of us felt like this whole concept did come along on the same train as when we were talking about affordable housing. And so I think that we do think of it as it's supposed to be part of our affordable housing, how we're trying to incorporate that into Kirkland.
And we heard part of that from the Planning Commission. That's something we're going to look at in terms of maybe some of the things that Mike mentioned. Could it be a carriage house? Could it be 100% for one unit? Redmond has something similar that they have in their books. Something to explore as part of this process.
During your focus groups, was there any specific mention about the possibility of a 15 or an 1,800 square foot unit next to a smaller carriage house that would be individually owned of 800 or 900 square feet? And was there a reaction to that, good or bad?
That didn't come up, but actually that is the case. The Danielson Grove project, two of the units are smaller. One of them is, 700, and one's 900 or something like that. Now, they were not, again, they sold for market price, so they were not, quote, affordable. But that really didn't come up. But again, I don't think anybody had any particular feelings one way or the other that I remember about the idea of the smaller units up at Danielson Grove.
Well, I think having a little bit of variety would make it more interesting.
Yeah, but again, you know, the problem with going a lot smaller, again, is you're still building the most expensive parts of the house. And so that's, I think what's happened, if you look at the evolution of the whole cottage concept, you know, it started out, and you can just watch the projects that the cottage company has done. Their first ones in Langley were 600 square feet. You know, then they go to 1,000, and now, you know, I don't know, the ones out, their latest versions out in Redmond are, you know, 2,000 square feet or more, because I think what they find is that again, what you're not building is the space that people actually kind of like to have, that extra bedroom or whatever else, and it's relatively inexpensive to build. So it starts to make sense to go to a bit bigger like that. But again, I think the market is still trying to figure out exactly what's the stopping point there that you know gets you as much as people want and not too much.
You didn't indicate on here what the sales price per square foot is, as you gave us just what it was per house.
302 versus 192 average, based on the numbers.
You did the numbers on
that? Yeah, you can do that.
302?
The most expensive per square foot, I think, were the smaller units at Danielson Grove. Again, because their sticker price was lower, but they're much smaller. So.
Well, but isn't there, I mean, if they're getting over $100 more per square foot of the construction, doesn't that tend to offset their higher construction costs?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, that's good, but they had to. I mean, he was just operating on a strict market basis there, so, yeah.
These are also very, very nicely done.
No, I'm just saying, you know, when we're talking about the affordability, I mean.
There's ways to, you deal with that. But
there are projects, and I've not actually seen these, but I'm told up in Snoqualmie Ridge development, one of the developers did sort of their requirement for affordability. They simply took some of the units, and you don't know which ones they are as you go down the street, but you go inside and they would be, you know, Formica countertops and vinyl floors and, you know, the really inexpensive sort of finishes that brought the price down on those quite a bit, but you wouldn't know
it. Yeah. Our houses.
That used to be nice, you know.
Exactly.
The granite and tile and all that sort of stuff. They just went for much less expensive finishes inside, but you wouldn't know it from the outside to drive down the street that that's the affordable one. And that's a technique that can work.
Can they do that and still get bring the price down, but the cost commensurately down and still get a decent return out of it?
You know, you won't get a substantially lowered by. You still got to build all the stuff, but yeah, it can work, and that's something to look into in terms of how to do an affordability.
Well, granite and tile are a lot more expensive than linoleum
As time moves on and we look at different alternatives, is there one thing out of this that you grabbed as advice for the city? To look at, for different councils to look at, in terms of these are the really important things to focus on. It's either affordability, or it's quality, or it's scale, or it's variation, or is it all of it? I mean, what should we really focus on?
The focus groups were a very revealing thing, because when we first started out in the early part of the meeting, people were kind of skeptical of this stuff. They didn't know why they were going. They didn't know why they were there. So we gradually introduced the topic of housing. I showed them slides of a bunch of other projects, the shoreline ones, and they were kind of skeptical. Once they visited the projects, they walked through them, they understood the whole deal, they thought they were wonderful. So to me, the big advice, or the real challenge is a communication challenge more than anything else, is how do you get people to, number one, understand the policy context? If the policy context has something to do with infill development and growth management and all that, you're almost starting from zero. The level of knowledge of growth management is almost non-existent out there. So people say, well, why should we have things more dense? I mean, why? Well, say, well, it's got to do with blah, 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 blah. Once they sort of get that, okay, that makes some sense. They can buy into that. So it's really, and then the whole issue of choice. A lot of people, it's just not occurred to them because they personally are not in the market for another kind of house, you know. Okay, well, yeah, there actually are quite a lot of people who'd like to have that smaller house. And so it's the challenge, it seems to me, and the whole thing is, how do you communicate with, I don't know how many thousand voters there are in Kirkland, in a way that gets them to the point where it took me 3 hours with these people to get. you know, understanding the policy context, appreciating what you can do with these different, you know, as you said, you can do different things with design that really make the project, even though it's a higher density, not seem it. You know, how do you move people down that? It seems to me is the real. So you know, the advice is to for me would be, you know, concentrate at this point on communicating with people and figure out how do you. And there's a bunch of stuff in the report of how to do that. You know, getting people to understand why you're doing it and sort of what are the advantages to the community of doing this. Well, otherwise, it seems sort of arbitrary or it's just, you know, in the absence of that, people assume it's something that, you know, developers have bought their way in and, you know, they're just going to make a bunch more money. Mm-hmm. You know, that's sort of the assumption always, unless you have some other kind of policy context for it.
We find this to be, I must say, disappointing. Because the Housing Task Force came up with the idea, a number of different ideas, to make more affordability. And I think the projects are great. Don't misunderstand me. I went and walked all around, looked at all of them, and they're beautiful and everything. But other than just filling in the land as fast as we can here, I would like to see that there be, that the people that work in our city, our firemen and our policemen, our planners, some of us older people can still afford to live here and buy something to live in this town. And I know this may sound against what this project is, but I'm not against the project itself. I think that they're beautiful. But if we're going to do this, we've got to figure out how to keep quality in it, because otherwise it'll turn into rentals. And that'll downgrade neighborhoods after a bit. And I don't know how I'm going to make them more affordable. So maybe you'll have to have Formica on a few of the counters. So people, I have Formica on my counters. I don't have to have tile on my floors. I live very nicely in my little house. And I'm sure there are a lot of people that would be more than happy with that. They don't have to have an $800,000 house or $1 million house to be happy to live someplace. That's my opinion.
Well, I think that's the challenge, is
how do we do that?
You know, what is there any way that we can design our regulations so we get something that looks great, that doesn't impact neighborhoods negatively, but still somehow carries a price tag that, you know, maybe a single earner could actually own the house. You know, somebody who's not dual income working could.
Well, I think the one of the places to start is if indeed what you're doing here is always going to be an alternative to the existing zoning. So the builder has the option of building what the current zoning allows or doing this other thing. You always have to sort of be cognizant of at what point do they decide I'm just going to do the regular thing at $900,000 or whatever it's going, you know, going to keep going up to. Or how do you keep them interested in doing this alternative thing that may include an affordable component to it? And most of them are pretty much numbers driven. You think you have to kind of assume that. There are a few other creative and want to do interesting things, but most of them are going to kind of look at, okay, what pencils better? So you say, okay, you could do this thing, and if you do, you know, have some of your parking as a detached garage and put a carriage unit over the top of that that's going to be 600 square feet and finished minimally, that's your affordable component there. You can sell it as a condominium kind of unit. I mean, that may be a way they could say, yeah, okay, I can do that. I keep making money doing that. But if you say, no, you got to take one of these standard size units and make that available to somebody who's making 80% of the median income and thereby subsidize it through the rest of the units, they're going to say, I'm not going to do that. So it's really, you know, just kind of keep in mind the thought process of the builder who's making that choice. Do I do the standard? Do I do the alternative? And they're driven by a spreadsheet and trying to understand how that figures out, I think, is a real important part of that.
Well, what's the possibility that we as a city sort of sweeten the pot a little bit if they do?
Well, sure.
That's the 3-1.
Again, that's all part of the calculation they do.
An adjustment to have one or two that ordinary people can live in.
So then, what is that adjustment? Is it like cramming more people in? Is it?
No, I mean, I didn't mean like that, Betsy. I meant like Okay, say of the bungalows that are up there. Say maybe that two of those. They're already getting at the extra land and everything, but maybe some incentives could be done and they could do a little less of the trim on the inside or something and make
those. Oh, sure.
And the city could say, okay, we'll give you a certain allowance. So you're not going to put tile floors in. We'll give you a blah, 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 a little extra on top of that to make this affordable for people that live here.
A little extra what?
Well, what's the blah, blah? See, that's the devil's in the details of the blah, blah, blah. You're giving them extra height, or you're giving them extra density, or you...
That's something we'll have to look at.
Not charge them for their permits or something. I don't know.
There's a number of tools.
Some way to do something.
I think the best thing to do is, you know, sit down with a handful of these people and just kind of walk through that and just figure out what their interest, you know, where their interest would be, because they know what they can sell and what they can't. And they probably have somebody, all sorts of ideas for you.
I'm sure they do.
Well, yeah. I know I don't have the right ideas, but...
I probably didn't read this as carefully as I should have, but what is the minimum lot that one of these would be put on?
1,500 square feet for I'm sorry, not the lot. That's the size of the unit.
Well, it's two-thirds of 7,200, whatever that is.
3,600.
It's about...
Well, two-thirds.
It's a 50%
4,600 or something.
46?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the actual lot size, if you look at, for instance,
Well, I'm sorry, what I mean is for an innovative housing...
How much land do
they need? How much land do they need?
Where are these... Size.
What
is the minimum development size, or was there one?
Where would these really be?
These are both about two-acre sites, I think.
Yeah, they bark, right.
And...
But we do talk about perhaps either combination of some duplex, triplex ideas, and we'll have to decide on what our comfort level is for a minimum lot size for these. But could it be half acre, could it be an acre? We don't have a lot of land left, for one, and
right.
Very few two-acre parcels in the city anymore, too. So we'll have to look at that and see what makes sense. It may be somewhat of a sliding scale, you know, for example. The one thing I wanted to mention, too, which I think is kind of an interesting social phenomenon, particularly with the Danielson Grove property, and not so much, I think, with the bungalows, but they actually created their own little community, and they have their own community center, a little building. They have potluck dinners together. They help each other with their yard work. You have usually a lot of single women that live in these. I think more than that than the Kirkland bungalows, for example, but they've kind of... It's really a social kind of network anymore, too. And I'm sure during the storm, they probably all got together at some point and helped each other out. But it's a really interesting thing to see that kind of, social behavior as a result of the way they designed it and the way they've set it up. So I thought it was kind of an interesting benefit from this.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
It's kind of like that co-housing idea, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. Right.
They say that the whole cottage concept is somebody described it as co-housing without all the meetings. But what's interesting is that there were people who, when I met with the residents, who some people at the Kirkland Bungalow said, "Yeah, I looked at the Danielson Grove, and I couldn't live like that. You know, I don't want to be part of this club." And then there were people at Danielson Grove said, "Hey, I looked at the others, but I wanted to be in a community." You know, mm-hmm. So it was really two very different groups of people in terms of their interest in being part of that.
And it's called alternative.
Yeah.
I'm curious if the issues that I'm curious about are the density, the number of people that are actually residing there versus, you know, if it was the larger scale, and also the traffic. Those are two issues that I'm curious about, and that's something that we may, you know, go back a few years from now and get a better read on. But can we learn anything from other projects over in other areas as far as whether you see a similar density and traffic issue as this?
If you look at the people who actually bought these and moved in, the Kirkland bungalows were singles and couples. There were no children there, at least as of when they were sold.
Mm-hmm.
So... I think the sheet, do they have the sheet that shows the buyer profile? Because there is one, I don't know if you have it.
There is one in here.
It shows, so the population there probably, you know, you could argue that the total population of the site is actually lower than what it would have been if you built 10 large houses with a bunch of, you know, mm-hmm. buyers with kids who are going to be teenagers with cars and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
The Anderson Grove, interestingly enough, has several children in it, which is really a first for cottage development. I think it's just because they're a bit larger. I think there's only one of them who's a teenager, some very little, very young children in there. You know, one of the things you have to look at, again, is that whole, you know, per square foot cost. You know, if you, for the $475,000 you'd pay for a Kirkland bungalow, you can go out a couple more miles and get a full-size older house, you know, for plenty of room for your kids to run around in. So they really aren't marketed, you know, very well at families. It's just not a good value there. The kind of intangibles you like in there, the sense of community and those sort of things, you know, people have kids. That's kind of secondary. They want space. They want a lot of bathrooms. You know, looking down the road, it will be kind of interesting to see whether they, you know, how the owner profile changes. But right now, again, I think if you look at the overall population on the site, it's probably lower than it would have otherwise been.
Yeah.
And the car ownership is probably about one car per adult or a little less. I mean, there's some single car family, you know, couples with one car in some of them.
As far as the traffic issue, have we learned anything from projects that have matured, that have been around longer, that they have more years of study to determine whether there is more traffic from this kind of project than the...
I'm not aware of any that have been evaluated sometimes down the road. Again, there, you know, a project of 15 houses is kind of hard to see in the larger context of traffic impact, you know, from a project of that size. Mm-hmm. Plus, you know, the bungalows is a cut-through street now. I mean, that's one of the things people who lived on there complained. You know, they've cut a street through between 132nd and whatever that 130th or whatever mm-hmm. it is. And so they're getting, some of those traffic counters were picking up people who were, you know,
cutting through
there. Obviously, the Danielson Grove project is a little less convenient cut-through there to wind through the neighborhood. Again, I'm not aware of any studies that have been done. Most of these projects haven't been around that long.
Yeah. I guess everybody's really in. That's my read on this. We're not improving we're not achieving any greater density, and most likely, by doing this than what we do with our conventional housing. We're maybe the traffic is a wash, or maybe it's a little higher. Who knows? I'm guessing it just makes sense to me. There's going to be more traffic if you've got more units of the number of mature people that are living there, then, but maybe not.
Well, it's also a function of what people, you know, living in a household with kids, I can tell you there's a lot of trip generation with kids.
Yeah.
You know, when people are just a single or a couple, they go to work, they come home, there's a little, you know.
Driving them to practice and whatever.
Yeah.
I guess my biggest concern with this whole thing is the potential for a lower quality development that would not be acceptable to the neighbors. Everybody loves the way these are done because they're done such high quality, but unless we've got some safeguards in our ordinance that assures that we're not going to have a low quality project and we're just praying that the market doesn't come that way. You never know when some goofball developer is going to come in and do something cheap. You know, it happens, and I would not want to be the person living next door to that project and suddenly seeing, you know, what would have been some nice development at just a cheap, you know...
pink vinyl siding.
that's my biggest concern with this whole concept. If you can safeguard against that, then it's just an alternative way of developing property, and if maybe we get $100,000 or $200,000 less cost per house out of it, that's, even though it's not affordable housing, it's relatively more affordable, and that's not a bad thing. So, but my personal feeling is only if you get the safeguards. That's...
And again, I think, you know, builders who want to do the alternative kind of thing are accustomed to going through one or two more hoops. Question is, how many of those will they withstand before they say, it's not worth it?
Mm-hmm.
That's...
I just say, it sounds like we have a couple developers who have shown some interest and who, it sounds like Cam West mm-hmm. seems to be interested in some of them. And so maybe somehow develop some partnerships or some associations or something, and we encourage those people to, you know, I mean, I don't know how we can do that or if it's even fair, but I mean, if there's a way to encourage certain things and discourage other developers from knocking at your door. I don't
know. There are ways.
Paul, you'd mentioned the amount of land available in Kirkland, the number of lots that are of a 2-acre plus size. I know they're pretty small amount of those properties. Is it possible that you could get back to us in terms of what you as a staff would think would be the smallest kind of size to put a, you know, is it a 30,000 square foot lot? Could they get 4 units on it instead of the normal 3 now? And with the cost of infrastructure today, I mean, does, I don't know how that pencils out actually, but where does it make sense on the smallest lot size available to do an alternative kind of project to think about that we could write some sort of zoning for? And how many of those are actually available and developable in the area? Mm-hmm. I mean, are we talking about 30 properties?
Well, and yeah, at some degree you have to be somewhat careful about that because somebody could take down an existing house and then consolidate lots. And
right.
You have to do some assumptions on that. But I think we can maybe come up with some general idea about that. The other side of the coin is, too, is that you don't want something that has 100 units of this. It just doesn't work that way.
Right.
You know, so you have to set up on the other side of the
max.
Look at the max, maybe, or is there some geographic separation or something that maybe, you know, gives a more distribution throughout the city. So they're not one after another. So there's something in there now that does set forth locational criteria, the neighborhoods, but that's something that was for the demonstration project. We can look at that again to see how that might apply.
Also, the ordinance at this point says that
it seems like the ordinance achieved what it wanted to achieve, and actually was written, the interim one is actually written pretty well, it seems like, and maybe it just needs to be somehow just tweaked a little bit more to look at that quality issue.
Well, then we're inflating the affordability issue, though. I mean, what are we going to tackle? Affordability, or no, it's got to be nice, or it's next to my house. I mean,
well, I think it sounds like we can possibly get both, though, if people. I mean, I really do think that sometimes these developers are putting in the marble and the granite and the tile and all of that stuff when they don't need to, because that's the going thing right now, and they know that's what people want. But like Elsie said, if 2 or 3 of these units didn't have that, one would think that that would...
It still look pretty nice. You guys want to come over to my house? It's not that bad.
I don't know if we can say one's more important than the other.
I think having a decent place to live is important. Being able to get to your job in 15 or 20 minutes and not have to travel a long ways.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing to me how many people are willing to drive further so they'll have the kind of home they want, though. I mean, that statistic always amazes me.
Well, the kind of home they can't afford, because a lot of times they have to drive way out there, because that's where you can find a house that's under $400,000. It's way out there. So, again, that affordability comes in and causes, you know, congestion, pollution, more highway building, blah, blah, you know. It's all related.
The affordability, do we want to weigh in on whether we think that this truly should be absolute affordable, or just we're satisfied that you get relative affordability by having houses that are 100 or 200,000 less in price, even though they're half the size? Is that something that we should be giving them some direction on?
I think we're not looking at this as having an entire complex as having everything affordable. I think that's going to be impossible to
mm-hmm.
repeat.
Right.
One or two units, or a bonus that might, or something that might be an incentive to tip that balance point that way. That's
mm-hmm.
that's all.
I'd only note that if you
have an affordability component to it, you have to decide whether that's going to be something regulated over time or not. And, you know, mm-hmm. because, you know, you could build one that's sort of affordable from the get-go, mm-hmm. and it might, you know, it might turn around, somebody might turn around and flip it and make a nice profit by putting in the granite countertops that weren't there.
Exactly.
So you kind of decide how you want to play that, because yeah. if something that's regulated over time with resales, that's done, but it's another kind of complexity to the whole thing.
Yeah.
That has to be factored in.
We do that a lot. I mean, it's very common to be able to do that.
Well, this brings me to a question. These are individual bungalows, homes, cottages. Aren't they owned individually?
Yes. Yes.
But they...
It depends.
...belong to the homeowners association, which tells them to mow their lawn or pull their weeds or...
Paint their house, what colors...
Yeah, there's a lot of different ways to do it. These two projects are all fee simple, so people own the dirt under their house. The bungalows... Most of the site is divided into individual lots, and then there's some tracts that are commonly owned. The stormwater ponds and the little open space in back are owned in common through the Homeowners Association. If you look at the plat map for the Danielson Grove project, the individual lots aren't much bigger than the houses themselves, and a lot more of the land is owned in common. But again, you still own the dirt underneath them. A lot of cottage projects elsewhere are done as condominiums, so you don't own the land at all. I mean, everybody owns all the land in common, and that's done too, and that works fine. I mean, it can be done in, you know, either way. They'll all have a homeowners association of some kind. You know, if you have a condominium, your homeowners association obviously is a much stronger thing, you know, to regulate maintenance and that kind of thing. Homeowners associations and fee simple projects can kind of go away over time if they're not really maintained and enforced. But you can do it both ways.
Okay. There we go from being a nice looking development in 5-6 years. The homeowners association or whatever's in charge of keeping the vegetation up and the lawns and the miscellaneous things around there, that goes away. One family is not going to say, hey, I think we should do the whole place now because nobody else is doing anything.
Well, you know, there's a development I think you should have a look at if you're interested in this, and it's called Cherrywood, the Orchard at Cherrywood Lane, or Cherrywood Lane at the Orchard, or something like that. It's down in Renton Highlands, and it was done as a special demonstration project by the city of Renton, and they're fee simple homes. They're fairly big. I mean, they're in the 2,000 plus range, but they're on 3,500 square foot lots, and they have a homeowners, and they have a big park in the middle. It's a really a nice development, and you go down there, and it's just beautifully maintained, and it's been there for probably 10 years. So, and it's not a real high income area. So somehow they, and that's when I'd like to see how they do their homeowners thing, because they really put a lot of money into the landscaping there. It's just beautifully done, and again, it's not a high income area at all. So they figured out something, and I'd be curious. But you know, you raise an interesting point, and I don't know. There are, I think, techniques for sort of trying to keep homeowners associations enforceable somehow, and I'm not real familiar with how that's done, but that is an important
point.
Well,
it could look very bad in 7 or 8 years if nothing was done.
Typically, it's their own investment. It's their own economic benefit to maintain and keep it up, particularly in this market, because and I'm a member of my homeowners association, and I'm in a townhouse complex, and it increases your market value. So there's a real, you know, built-in incentive to keep it maintained. Doesn't mean everybody does it as well as they could, but for the most part, it's like your own home. There's people who do better than others.
Yeah. There's only so much you can legislate.
Maybe we should encourage nobody mows their grass, nobody takes care of the yard to keep the prices down.
There you go.
They do vegetation.
What we can.
Are we giving you the kind of feedback you're looking for, or are we being too vague? Is it?
I'll give you one little piece of feedback. I don't like zero lot lines, so that was one of those alternatives that they had suggested.
You don't like my unit?
Huh?
You don't like my unit?
You know, I just like a little bit of space, you know, especially when it's a detached unit, to have a little bit of space, someplace for the kids to go out and do something. So, I mean, that's just my two cents on that one. That was one of the alternatives, and I just, mixed-use things, I'm interested in mixed-use. I like the carriage house idea, all of those, but I haven't seen zero outlines that I really liked very well for families.
Those are basic questions, which I just need explained. When the stormwater retention ponds are built, who's responsible for that pond, the city or the homeowners association?
Homeowners association. Typically, unless it's in the right-of-way, and it's conveyed to the city at that point.
Okay, and so if there are drainage ditches through, they're in charge of that too, right? Okay. And then what is a bioretention swale?
It's a ditch.
I
couldn't help myself.
It's a friendlier sounding ditch.
It's a ditch.
It's mostly designed to infiltrate the water and be a little more environmentally sensitive without, you know, having it run directly into the stormwater system, retain the water on site for a while, and infiltrate out some of the pollutants.
I guess we're a little shallower.
Yeah.
Grass in them.
The mechanics
are next to the roads.
The Kirkland Douglas. If you go up there, what you'll notice on the in the right of way between the street and the homes, you'll see a bioswale.
That's what that was.
That's kind of a shallow ditch. Collects the water.
Like a place, and if you had too many glasses of wine, you might put your car.
But it's interesting. Both these projects, they applied low impact development techniques. It wasn't required, but they felt like they had a better system that they used. On these two projects, and we think it works better, and we're looking at some of those techniques even more so in other projects.
Okay. Anything else? Should we wrap up?
I got one last thing to say.
Oh, sorry.
I would like to see us learn some from shoreline and go very slowly, not put us in a position where maybe do two more of these things. So we and then kind of review it a little bit and go on to the next two, not put eight in and decide we don't like any of them or something.
Well, and perhaps we do have some sort of regulation where we stipulate that we like these ditches and all of these things, and we'd like, you know, this is what we want, developer, and we're going to come visit you during this development, and if you are not building it that way, then we're going to stop it, or somehow have it so that we are monitoring this, if there's any way you can do that.
Well, hopefully a lot of this will be discussed up front so that they have a better picture of what they have before they actually start the project, because that's the one thing they don't like to, is they like predictability. Everybody likes predictability. So it's better to have the rules up front and know what the standards are and go to the project and move forward.
Right. Yeah. I agree.
Okay. Thank you, Mike.
Thank you.
And Dorian.
Didn't mean to insult your house.
What's that?
Didn't mean to insult your house.
I think so.
A hard time, but.
Yeah, just giving him comments. We're not. And I remember that there was some concern. Will you be able to get these comments to the city council? I know there was some concern about it maybe being too close to a meeting. Will you be able to do that?
We can pass those off.
Great. And the last item on our agenda is taking action on Ordinance 4065 floor area ratios, which we think pretty clearly decided we didn't mind to do with. We didn't have, but I guess we have to go through the steps.
The rest of the city has it.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, what we did was we built into the actual code itself the exemption for Holton. So we're recommending to be clear, you adopt the resolution which adopts the ordinance which provides the exemption for Holton.
I didn't read this.
Yeah, so what we do is if we adopt the ordinance, then it still doesn't apply in Holton.
Yeah, that's the way it reads, right,
yeah.
Paul?
Right. So resolution number 40. I'm sorry, 65.
4065.
4065.
That's ordinance. Resolution number
2006-8
is the resolution you would be recommending you approve, which adopts the ordinance, which the ordinance contains language that exempts Houghton from the provisions of the racial standards.
Huh?
I should have read this. I didn't even.
I'm in favor of it. Just basically,
you know, see what we're doing.
It's
totally
from the regulations. In the ordinance.
As an ordinary citizen, do they ever see these? But boy, would that be confusing.
Do they see what? The ordinance?
See, like, you know, where it says, this ordinance where it says that Section 6, that.
In the ordinance itself,
we
yes.
We don't want to do it, you
that's
know, and
that's
then
codified.
It turns around and says that we just voted for it.
That's
wouldn't that be very confusing? I don't want you to change it. I understand why we're doing this. But.
Actually, I'm not sure I do understand. Why are we doing this?
So, okay, let me try to explain. You have three options. Either one works. So you can take your choice. But when we adopted the ordinance on floor area ratios, we put certain sections in there that really specified that these do not apply in Houghton. So the ordinance already says that these provisions do not apply in Houghton. So by adopting a resolution, adopting the ordinance already contains those provisions that exempt Houghton from the floor area ratio standards.
Yeah, I understand. Yeah. Why did you do that, though?
So that they can adopt the ordinance.
It's clear that people that read the ordinance, they know that in the ordinance that it's there, you're exempt. That doesn't apply in Houghton, in the actual zoning code.
And we still have to take action on it.
Right. Well, you don't have to take action on it. It can go.
Well, taking no action is yields.
It's the same thing.
Yeah.
Exactly.
But I do have a point of clarification for
sure.
You. On the second page, we have A, B, and C. Item A says if we approve the ordinance, it shows our support of the amendment. And the question was, the amendment, are we supporting the word excluded or not included, or are we supporting that the city council passed the amendment in the first place?
You're supporting the amendment to be not included. So the ordinance excludes you from the requirements. And so you're supporting the ordinance that excludes you from the requirements. Is that?
I know I have to sign it. It's confusing. Would anybody read this? I mean, would anybody come in the planning department and be reading this for some reason?
If you look at the zoning, If you look at the zoning code, it'll have the language in the ordinance that says this does not apply in Houghton. That's the way the ordinance has been approved. So by passing the resolution, you're stating that in the zoning code, these rules do not apply in Houghton. And that's the ordinance that was amended. So
I'm all for it.
Me too. I just have to give bad time.
Okay, now, Betsy.
Yes.
I'm all for it. I'm confused again. It. Which part of it are you for?
I can be for actually A or C. I'm for it. But I would prefer A, because I think we should just take a positive step, which is approve the ordinance, because they have taken all this time to craft it so that it excludes us from what we said we didn't want.
It's okay.
Gosh, when you say that out loud, I say absolutely, I agree with that. But in reading how it's written, it's still ambiguous to me. Because when I was at home going through this, I'm thinking, no, I think really B is what I want. I want to say that I didn't approve the ordinance being changed in the first place. And is it important for our council to reaffirm that we didn't need the ordinance changed in the first place?
Well, the ordinance...
Either one of those gets you to the same place, so your choice, really, how you want to state it. You know, it's.
But in time,
I mean, the rest of the city wants the ordinance. The rest of the city wants their FAR regulations, and Houghton doesn't want it. So by approving this ordinance, we give the city their FARs.
And we don't have FARs.
And we don't have FARs
at home.
I'm reading this technically, it's confusing. I mean, I don't understand why we've got section 6 and 7 in there when you've already addressed at the end of each section that it doesn't apply to Houghton. And I don't know, it's just, it's, the whole thing's kind of confusing to me.
Well, they made some changes. This they did in their foreign regulations, okay? And in order for us to be excluded from them, it has to say on the bottom here that we don't have it in our area. Plus, there are some foreign regulations, I think, that are not listed on here, right, Paul? Aren't there some other regulations that are not listed with this?
No, this is these are the FAR regulations, and okay, there are regulations that deal with...
Because like the city just passed at the city council 7.5 feet on each side of the building. Well, that's a FAR thing, and we don't do FAR. We're not doing FAR. And this is all right. Paul would not lead us astray.
Yeah, I think what it just means, Vic, is that... If we didn't approve this ordinance, it wouldn't make any difference. It wouldn't make any difference. However, yeah, I mean, and so the city could just go, okay, but we are going to approve the ordinance, so then it would come back to Houghton Community Council, and we would disapprove it, and so then it would say, okay, then these regulations don't apply in Houghton, which they already don't apply in Houghton. But...
Yeah, the main reason was to have in the code so that when people read the zoning code, they know it's clear that it doesn't apply in Houghton. And that's why it's codified by the language in the ordinance.
And I've seen that in other parts of the zoning code where it says this doesn't apply in Houghton.
From my standpoint, what you just said, Paul, is clear. The part that's not clear is by our actions of voting for A, B, and C on page 2, do we support the changes that the city council adopted, but we're just not including them now into Houghton? Or do we support that all of the changes the city council adopted are not included in the Houghton? Because on section 6, it says the first sentence after the comma, ordinance 2001 comma, is subject to the disapproval by the Houghton Community Council, but we're voting on what we do is we support.
You support the ordinance which excludes Houghton. So, I'm not sure I can make it any clearer, but by supporting the ordinance, you're supporting the intent to exclude Houghton from the regulation.
I think Section 6 is common language that's in every ordinance that would come under the jurisdiction of Houghton Community Council, including this one. So with any ordinance that is under our jurisdiction, this little clause, sentence 6, is going to, clause 6 is going to say that it's going to come to us for our disapproval. It's just like Alice in Wonderland to see it on this ordinance, because it's almost like it's a mirror coming back at you saying, but if we disapprove the thing that says that we don't approve, does that mean that now we're approving it now? But we're not.
Well, is there a way that we could make that really clear in the resolution? Just so someone else might not, in a year from now, go, hey, wait a minute, it really meant to say, and just so it's really clear, at least on tape and part of the permanent record, the exact intentions of the Houghton Community Council are to not have FAR regulations.
In fact, that's the fourth whereas in the resolution. It says that. Whereas, Houghton Community Council determined that it did not desire to have the proposed amendments applied to the Houghton Community Council. You could add the word FAR amendments or FAR regulations if you want to specify that.
I'm still, the 6 and 7 is what kind of threw me, Paul. When I was reading through, I was following you up to that point, and then I thought, God, why?
6 and 7, as Betsy indicated, is standard language that really is then embodied in option A, B, or C. So that's your standard disapproval language that says you have the authority to do these things.
I understand that, but is it typically incorporated in the language of the ordinance?
Of every ordinance.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
Is it true?
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. It has that language.
Yeah, it is.
Well, then, if that's true, if those two paragraphs are in...
Yeah. That's what gives us our power.
Exactly.
That's what gives us our power for the disapproval is this week.
If you're confident in that, then I'll go with you.
Okay, here we go. Okay, Paul, we snookered him, didn't we?
I know you don't want it either, so I'm not worried about that. I just assumed you were going to say, no, we're not going to do it, and I didn't even bother reading it. I apologize for not being prepared, Paul.
It was tricky.
It was tricky. We struggled with this ourselves. How do we bring this forward? But
so.
Okay. I move we approve resolution number 2006-8.
Is that what we need to be approving?
Yes.
Okay. I second that.
It's been moved and seconded that we approve this resolution. Any further discussion? John, you okay with it?
Yeah.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries.
Thank you. Sorry for the confusion, but
that's okay.
Idiosyncrasies with.
Yeah.
Honestly, Paul, I don't think it's your issue.
Not entirely. We struggle with this ourselves, how to put this together. So.
Okay, and we have no other new business or any administrative reports?
Oh. I'm going to make one official announcement. I will not be here for the January meeting.
Yeah, we know.
Drinking
margaritas. Drinking
margaritas.
Okay. All right. With that, Paul.
Same to you.
Thank you, Paul.
Meeting adjourned.
I'm good.